Hi and welcome. This is Douglas Lynn and you're joining us for another episode of Insider Stories. This week we're joined by Kyle Falvo, who is a QuietSpec insider. He's Brother 52 on QS and he is also a Magic Finance aficionado and trader, and here to talk about his role in Magic Finance as well as his recent experiences at GP New Jersey. So Kyle, first of all, welcome.
Thanks. Hi, nice to see you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name's Kyle Falvo. I've been a co-host of a few smaller podcasts, usually kind of the finance aspect of those podcasts. I casually write some finance articles, and I use Magic Finance to travel the world, meet interesting people, and buy their collections.
That's excellent stuff. So how long have you been playing Magic?
Well, I started in 1994, so Revives, Fallen Empires, but then I discovered Girls. I picked the game back up when I was working for an after-school daycare in around 2002, 2003, but it really wasn't until Duels of the Planeswalkers and Mirrored and Besieged that brought me back into the game financially.
What was it about those that hooked you back in?
Well, it was really interesting. Their promotion for that game was where they were like, hey, you can get a free card if you come down to a card shop. And at that point, I was like, oh my God, Magic still exists. And what happened was I came down to the card shop, picked up my promo, and instantly went on eBay to see what this thing was worth, and found out that, oh, there's a huge market for these Magic cards, and I've got a bunch sitting in my basement from back when I was a kid.
Did you have any hits that you found when you looked through that collection?
Oh, yeah. Very first thing I sold was an Underground Sea, and it was pretty beat up, but I sold it, and this is right around the time that the duels had just jumped to around $100 from, I think, where they were sitting about 30 for many years. So it was a really good time to sell. Especially, I mean, the underground was, the condition of the underground to get 100 for it was pretty good at the time.
And you sold that through eBay then?
I did sell that through eBay, yeah.
And that was a time, that would have been what, four years ago maybe, 3 years ago?
So that sounds about right.
Before TCG Player, but still kind of recent enough so that eBay was fully fleshed out. Had you bought cards back in, you said, in 2002?
Well, you know, back in 2002, it was primarily bringing my old cards to the daycare to teach these kids how to play. And then they brought in Pokemon. I'm like, no. We're going to play a real game and introduce them to Magic. And so around that time, I'd gone back into the card shop and picked up a few boosters. I think Mirrodin was in at the time, but I could still pick up a couple cheap boosters of Urza's Saga and Urga's Legacy. But I think we're in the Onslaught Mirrodin time period then.
I think that was a good point in Magic, too. That was when some of the cards were really heating up in value. And I remember Mirrodin was one of those sets when it came out with a whole bunch of $10 and $20 rares in it. That was a good time to be playing.
Right, and even back then, I remember picking up Scry and having Scry magazine. Just the other day, I was looking at some of those and looking at the prices of some of these cards now. It's amazing.
Oh, you go back and it's also, you look at the price of some of those cards and they're just so hilariously mispriced even at that point that things like Ali from Cairo is probably listed as more expensive in Quest 1999 than it is now.
Right, right.
And then they have Lion's Eye Diamond for $2. So do you have a favorite card, by the way?
Well, I have to say, what happened to me was in GP Salt Lake, I was the winner of the Black Lotus from SCG's Gold Rush. So I have to say that the Black Lotus is my favorite card.
That is a cool story, and you still have it.
I do still have it. Yeah, I've got it sitting in a safety deposit box. I recently just had Christopher Rush sign the Star City Games sleeve that it came in, and I still have the envelope and all that good stuff. So I'm hoping that I can get a premium with it when I sell it with a picture of myself holding it in the Star City envelope, all that stuff. I'm hoping I can get another $500-$600 for it.
Well, and they just doubled in price, basically, over the weekend, too. Has that affected your decision on whether to sell it soon?
You know, I consider it, but it's one of those things where, barring some sort of decision by Wizards to get rid of the reserve list, that card's never going to go down.
Absolutely. And I think we were talking about it on the Quiet Speculation Forum earlier today, about this, and somebody had brought up that, you know, power will never go down in price. And that's something that people got to remember, is that these, you know, if you're going to buy these things or you're going to hold on to them, they're just going to get more and more expensive.
Right. And there is something that could bring it down. Like, there could be some huge economic downturn, or the game could see, you know, a drastic drop in player support. But as long as we have this kind of 20 to 30 somethings that are getting these good paying jobs and can afford to spend that kind of money on these cards, people will be selling them.
And it's still, the Black Lotus still had that prestige. I think Ben Blyweiss on the QS forums had actually posted a while back that, you know, every collectible has its Blue Mauritius stamp, its Honus Wagner, its Action Comics number one. Of course, Magic is going to have this iconic, rare, awesome card.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've never really collected outside of Magic the Gathering, you know, in terms of cards. But there was something recently that was brought up about misprints, and I guess there's a few baseball misprints, like a baseball card that has, somebody had written the word face on the bottom of a bat.
Oh yeah, that's a pretty notorious one. Yeah.
Right, right. Or the C-3PO with the penis on it.
Yeah, that's he seems to be surprised and happy to be in the photo. Those are, I think, $300, by the way.
Yeah, that's insane.
Bearing in mind that some of these cards can be expensive, certainly like that stuff, what helped you dip your way back into Magic Finance after you went on eBay, you discovered that this promo was worth something, there was a huge market for this stuff?
Well, trying to get more data at that point, I stumbled upon Star City Games, and so, you know, digging up the collection, finding those old cards, starting to read Jonathan Medina's Pack to Power series, that kind of stuff really got me interested in the game. You know, I'm in my mid-30s, and it's a great game. I love the game. It's fun to play. But the financial side of it, if that wasn't there, I don't think I would be spending so much time and energy dedicated to it.
So when you're collecting and you're doing the finance, are you rolling that into making a bigger collection or flipping it or going toward a goal?
Yeah, you know, it really depends on the opportunity at hand. Many times what I'm doing is I'm just doing a quick flip. That was what I did at GP New Jersey. Quick flip, take the profit, put it into something like a reserve list staple.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I flipped a $350 collection into getting my money back, $20, and with some of the store credit I already had, mixed that in to get a Volcanic Island to help me play for the weekend.
Oh, that's wonderful. So where did you find that collection, by the way?
It was here locally. It was advertised through Facebook, and you know, we've got a really awesome shop here locally that is comfortable allowing us to come in and make trades and make purchases in shop. He says it's safer to do it in the store with him than it is out in the parking lot. So
certainly,
that was really nice of him. And definitely. You know, we've got other LGSs in the area that aren't as progressive as that too. So sometimes you have to take a step outside, and that happens both at large tournaments as well as, you know, just smaller FNMs and things like that too.
So are you trading mostly standard right now or modern? Is there a niche that you like?
So recently I've acquired an out of a local store that does sales of singles on commission for store credit. So that's kind of what I've been doing in terms of focusing a lot on cons, getting all the cons out there. That's kind of started to dry up in the last couple of weeks now. So now it's kind of taking the remaining cards that I have in standard, probably buy listing a lot of that stuff out, and then starting to refill that binder with more modern staples, and maybe even throw a couple legacy things in there to see if I've got some big spenders.
Now, are you trading between rounds, going to Friday Night Magic? So where were you finding the people to trade with?
You know, honestly, I tend to find myself more of as a traveler type. I'm spending my weekends traveling to places outside of the state, either GPs or PTQs, things along those lines. And then setting up the travel really is the way to do it. So a couple of weeks before, I start scoping Craigslist and on the entire track that I'm going to be taking, and looking for ads, responding to ads, and then maybe 2 to 3 days to, up to a week before, posting my own ad saying I'm interested in buying the collection, setting up times to meet, all this on just my path to whatever tournament I'm going to that weekend.
That's incredible, Kyle. That is so cool. And that must be successful then, right?
Yeah, it's been really great. I mean, 2 years ago, me and a partner of mine, we traveled from Salt Lake City to the WMCQ in Chicago. We got to meet up with Kelly, which is nice. There was a PTQ the next day. Then we left from Chicago up through Canada, stopped in through Toronto and Ontario, I believe. Quebec. And then went off to GP Providence. From GP Providence, we went down to Florida, Florida over to GP Houston, and then finally ending. It's an amazing road trip, and it was, I'd say about maybe 2/3 of the trip was paid for just by flipping collections off Craigslist.
That's so cool, and that sounds like a multi-week road trip also that you got, you just bankrolled that way.
Yeah, luckily, I mean, my 9-to-5 is a teacher, so I've got some summer's off, winter breaks off, so I usually hit the road pretty quickly after that.
That's wild. That sounds so ambitious. Was that the first time you'd done something like that, or maybe perhaps the largest that you'd done at that point?
Well, me and my partner, her name's Trish, we gave a couple test drives. We'd done a couple tournaments together, traveled together, gone down to Vegas and back, and we kind of had an idea that this is what we wanted to do, and we gave it a test drive at GP Portland, which was maybe, I guess this is 2 years ago. And so what we had done was said, okay, we're going to leave Wednesday, Thursday, and let's go ahead and just start scoping out Craigslist ads and posting Craigslist ads. And, you know, with one of us driving, one of us being able to communicate with these people, we were able to set up a good string. It took us an extra maybe day and a half, but we got to buy a lot of collections that way.
That's wild. So was it stuff where people knew what they had, or they were like digging boxes out of closets, or what was the kind of collections you got that way?
Well, one thing you might want to do is if you look on Twitter, I use a hashtag that I stole from Arthur Halliway, which is called Shop Crawlers, and it kind of describes is kind of a basic catch-all phrase for what it is that I'm doing, where I'm having shops or tournaments or whatever it is as my locations in mind and going to them and along the way picking up collections. So whenever I buy these collections on the road, I will post pictures of those collections and hashtag it with shop crawlers, because that's kind of what I feel like I'm doing at the time. And a lot of times these people don't know what they have. I'd say by far the biggest thing that happens, and this is something that I have a gold mine of a town in the middle of Nevada. And it's called Elko, Nevada. And what happens in Elko is you've got this group of players, and they are all in their kind of teenager to early 20s. They'll play Magic for a few years, and then most of them will go on and leave and go to college. Well, they're leaving behind at least one person who is not going off to college, and he ends up with all of the collection, right? But he no longer has anybody to play with, so he's not really interested in the cards anymore. Many times these cards are coming from not just his own collection, but from his friends who have left town. And he just wants to get his closet space back and get rid of all these cards. And he'll just put an ad up on Craigslist.
That's wild. You know, I'm looking at the hashtag right now. I encourage the listeners, go pull up Shop Crawlers. I'm seeing you have a whole bunch of older collections of stuff that you're looking at. And what a fun way to spend a road trip.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, and you gotta prioritize things. And yeah, I've gotten really good at knowing what to look out for. And, many of my finance articles that I've written have kind of related to that. What looks like a good Craigslist ad? What doesn't? Many times just that initial telephone conversation, you'll kind of get an idea about, oh, they have a gold mine and they don't know what they have. Or my favorite story is, somebody saw a Craigslist ad I had posted and called me and gave me a telephone number of a guy who I should call. So this person didn't even contact me. When I called the number, a little old lady answered the phone and said that, oh yeah, he'd probably be interested in selling his collection. And so I show up, and it's a 60-year-old woman and her 40-year-old son, and he has the most extensive collection of commons and uncommons, basically entire sets in binders, categorized, well organized by set and color. And while it was a huge hassle going through, probably spent about an hour looking through every single one of these binders, I was then at the end able to say, you know, there's a lot of stuff here I just can't buy, but I'll give you $15 for that portal binder and another $15 for that binder that has an onslaught fetch and a couple reanimates. And he was happy because he was able to, you know, make a little bit of money and get rid of, downsize some of his collection. And his interest wasn't so much in the actual value of the cards. He was more interested in the art itself. And so this allowed him to have more money to buy more boosters of the newer set and get more of the art.
That's fascinating, and it's wild how people access the games in the game in different ways, because there are people like you and me who are in on the finance side. There are people who are definitely on the collecting side. I certainly remember buying a collection from a guy who said that he and his dad used to collect it from years ago and had binders full of all these organized sets of Mirage and Visions and Weatherlight. And I certainly gave him a fair price on it. I felt kind of bad breaking the whole thing up, but, you know, I guess we're in this for to be flipping it. We're not in it to be collecting sets of Mirage.
Right.
So.
And many times.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, yeah, many times I'll get a collection and I won't even recognize that it's ordered in that way. There was a set that I'd bought, a collection I'd bought recently that had an entire set of all of the rares from Mirrodin, and I didn't even recognize that that's what it was. I was just pulling out the money cards, and it wasn't until I pulled them all out and realized, oh, these are all from Mirrodin. This is an entire set of all of the rares from Mirrodin.
That's wild. And I imagine that you probably were pulling out a whole bunch of cards from Mirrodin, because that is still a pretty expensive set to be buying singles from.
Right.
I recall that, you know, sometimes when you're looking through those and you find the expertly sorted box of stuff that people have made collections of, there's things like a stack of, like, I think it's Prismatic Circle from Mirage. I have a stack of maybe 26 of those. It's a Circle of Protection with Cumulative Upkeep. And you just end up with, you know, big amounts of these certain things. It's fascinating to see what people end up with in their own collections.
Definitely. Like, I'd say the two number one cards that you always find is a Visardrix and a Sol Ring.
Oh, the Visardrix thing is completely true.
I don't know if it's just one of those heavily printed rares that you end up with that just never ends up in a binder and always ends up into a box that ends up getting sold or what, but that card, man, it's everywhere.
I believe it was a promotional card at some point. And I've seen people with binders full of Visardrixes that they collect because nobody wants them. But here's the other question I've got for you, too. I feel like this is probably some wonderful thing of fate, but I feel like in nearly every collection I buy, there's going to be a Force of Will in it. And I think the reason is that people, like, I remember when I first read Force of Will when I was 11 years old, I had no idea what it does because it's got, like, 12 lines of text on it, you pay some life. You know, by the time you get down to the words counter-target spell, I've already stopped reading.
Right, and you just see that 5 mana cost, and you're like, 5 mana to counter a spell? I could pay 2 for that.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, that's why you find those minty Force of Wills in people's collections, because even if they're building the mono-blue deck full of all these counter spells, and I'm going to play Capsize and hate my friends here, Force of Will just never seems to make it into those because it only appears as like a 5 casting cost counterspell.
Right. And one thing I've noticed, and this is just within the last year, is those collections seem to have been drying up more and more. I'm not finding those revised era collections. I'm not finding that kind of cards from fourth edition or Ice Age or any of those. Now it seems like I'm finding more of these kind of 7th and 8th edition collections, and we're moving further along in the time spectrum of these collections. So I'm hoping I can still find those diamonds in the rough like that and find myself a Force of Will every couple months, but they're not as prevalent anymore.
You know, at the same time, I'm glad that we're moving to 7th and 8th as the stuff that's been being more common. I've seen a lot of Odyssey lately. is that there was that huge magic dead zone between the Dark and, let's say, Tempest, when nothing really held its value aside. You know, you look at alliances and there's Force of Will and then there's something, you know? Whereas at least in 7th and 8th there are some interesting cards, and then you have things like $80 Goblin Matron foils that randomly can pop up and make your day.
Right, and for me, I've been really lucky lately with getting these 7th edition foils, and I don't think people really recognize what those were, because, I mean, yes, that was the beginning of the foils, but then everybody had foils after that, so nobody recognizes that those are the first foils. Those are the ones that are worth the most.
Absolutely. They are very hard to find. And a lot of those cards, that's been the only time they've been printed in foil. And if you especially want the old frame foil, that's a big deal right there. So you found a lot of successes by buying collections. What are some tips to help people save time and avoid the collections that really aren't worth going out to visit?
Well, you know, the first thing I would do is, when you're looking at these things, is look at the distance away from the freeway. You know, if it's more than 20 minutes from the freeway or your kind of route of travel, it's got to be a really good collection. And it's hard to judge that just by talking on the phone to somebody. So many times what I'll do is have whoever it is meet me at some public location that's closer to the freeway. And that's a good thing to look for. The one thing I would ask is that if the person can tell me what era they played in, so I can get that kind of gauge or feel if it's a collection from that dead zone. Many times they'll say, oh, it's everything within the last 2 years. And I'll be like, well, okay, I'm not expecting to pay a lot of money for cards that have just recently rotated, or for cards that, you know, are currently in standard play that have already dropped in price. So those are the kinds of things I want to look out for early on. And then also it'll be things like, oh, I've got it in a binder, or sometimes, like, there was this one collection we picked up from a house that was full of smokers, and it was just a foot and a half by foot and a half cube of cards, not sorted, not piled, anything at all, and they just reeked and reeked of tobacco, and there was no way to get that smell off of those cards. And while there was some gems in there, the amount of time and energy it took to sort and organize these cards and pull those gems out was just not worth it.
I'd imagine that you'd also have to be doing that in the garden shed or something to avoid just stinking up the place.
You know, the thing, and this is probably the worst thing that I do, is I actually will sort while driving. I definitely would not encourage it on winding roads, but when you're driving across the country, there's a lot of straight shots. You're driving straight for 65, 70 miles an hour for many, many hours, and you can get a lot of sorting done during that time period.
So what is the proportion of people who you're buying collections from on Craigslist who have a fair idea of what their stuff is worth, and how often do you get the people who have grossly overinflated, or for that matter, underinflated ideas of what their cards are worth?
Well, I'd say a lot of the time people do have a grossly overinflated idea of what their collection is worth. Many times what they're looking for is somebody that is going to give them some TCG mid or some Star City Games price for their collection. And I'm usually very honest right up front when I meet them, after looking through the collection, that what my intention to do is to just go ahead and sell this collection for them. And the profits that I will be getting is from the smaller things that are not as noticeable, or those 7th edition foils, for example, right? That I don't have a good buy list price number in my head for those. Those will be just kind of part of my profit. So once I expressed that, and I'm open and clear and honest with them about that, they tend to be a lot more receptive and open to getting a buy list price, for their cards. It works the other way as well, where, a collection that they're completely undervaluing. Many times those people, they just don't know what they have. Either it was something they picked up at a yard sale, they bought some boosters at a particular time and wanted to teach themselves how to play and lost interest and have been holding on to them for years. It was really great traveling with Trish. She has experience working in a card shop. And so while I can stand there and I can quickly evaluate the price of these cards, many times how quick I do it and the how quick I just spit out a number to them. They're not as trusting, but with Trish there, she was able to take, it was a $50 portal collection that I had offered 20 on. She was able to get them down to $5, $10, just kind of expressing that, well, none of these cards are seeing play and we're not really going to get any value out of this. So we'll take it off your hands for $10. And, so that happens from time to time as well, where these people, they just want it out of their home. They have no attachment. They have no value to it. And many times what I'll do is I'll gauge that. One of the best collections I picked up was where in conversation while I'm sorting and pricing the collection, someone I mentioned that they were into video games and that they'd like to get a copy of Skyrim. Well, I know you can get Skyrim for $30 at the local GameStop. So I offered him $30 for the collection and told him he can go buy Skyrim at GameStop, and he was happy with that.
And given how much time you can play on that, I'm sure it was a pretty good trade for them versus musty old Magic cards.
Right. He was happy. He didn't need that Snapcaster Mage anyway.
I have run into people who have a grossly over-costed idea of what they have. I know I tried to buy a collection from one guy who Craigslist ad was like $100 firm. I got this collection at a swap meet. I know what I have. Don't try and hoodwink me. Don't try and talk me down. I went to visit him. He was nice enough. I looked at it. It was honestly literally just pickings of uncommons from Judgment and Odyssey. And I think the most expensive card in there was a Deep Analysis, which is like a quarter. And I broke it to him that, like, I'm not even going to make you an offer here because I don't want any of these things. And I think you have to walk that line of being honest with somebody but not insulting them. And I think he kind of got the point, and I think he also felt like he had been kind of screwed at this swap meet thing. But
right.
People are inviting you into their homes, and you don't really want to insult them about, like, you have no idea what you're talking about. But at the same time, you're not going to be paying somebody $8 on a Shivan Dragon.
Right, and I really respect the fact that people let you into their homes. I mean, it was an amazing way to see this country. I mean, yes, you could stop in and you can see, the tourist attractions, and you can stop at museums and you can do all these things and see the country that way. But by coming into people's homes, we were able to see how people lived and what college kids in Asheville, North Carolina were like, and so I respect that. And so I want to be very friendly and open and not have it just be a business transaction while I'm there. And so, yeah, explaining to people what's going on currently in Magic, because many of these people who are getting rid of these collections, they just don't know.
Kyle, you work with a lot of collections, and I'm sure there are a bunch of, the 50 cent to a dollar cards. Do you ever use Trader Tools to help you buy list those things?
By far, I'd say Trader Tools is the number one resource I use when I'm putting together the collection. It's useful for me on both ends. One, when I'm trying to give the person a price, I can go ahead and put everything in Trader Tools, create a list, see that list, see what that best buy list price is. And that best buy list price is not necessarily the price that I want to offer that person on that collection, but at least allows me to look and see what the value of these cards are. Having that list available to me when I then go to sell to a vendor is also useful. Again, I'm not expecting to get that best buy list price, but as close to that best buy list price I can get, that'll be great. This collection that I bought most recently, I paid $350 for the collection. I looked on Trader Tools. It said I could get about $450 as the best buy list price. I ended up getting $410. So not a bad way to go about it.
And it also certainly prevents you from ever losing money when you're buying a collection.
Exactly.
So you recently went to GP New Jersey. Did you do your collection sourcing while you were going to that?
So I knew that because I was going to GP New Jersey that the opportunity for flipping collections at the GP is higher than, say, at some local shop or at a smaller event. Having, maybe 15, 20 vendors on site creates a large amount of competition. They've got a lot of money that they want to spend, and the earlier you get there, the more you're going to get for that collection. So I started hunting for collections, 2-3 weeks in advance, knowing that although I'm tying some of this money up in a multi-hundred-dollar collection that I'm definitely going to be able to get that back as soon as I get on site. So, I was definitely scoping these collections, and the last week was a little frantic trying to do a lot of my own collection sorting and putting together a buy list for things I wanted to get rid of on site as well.
And were you able to find things in the area in New Jersey when you traveled in, or were these collections that you'd stocked up on before you went?
These are all collections I'd stocked up before I went. I knew that just because of my work schedule, I wasn't going to have a lot of extra travel time. Although I'd gotten a rental car, I knew that a lot of these vendors were arriving a day or two early. Not to mention, I did definitely scope out the New Jersey scene, and it was kind of hilarious. There was an ad posted for a collection for sale that was just literally a rant about how wrong it was for us to be buying collections from people at such small amounts. And it was definitely somebody angry that they had sold their collection for less than their value, and they were sending a message to anybody else that was going to be trying to hunt collections in New Jersey that what they were doing was wrong.
That's I suppose that's one way to handle that.
But yeah, no, I stayed away from, I usually tend to stay away from the city where the collection is. If I'm going to be arriving less than a day or two before the event, it's going to get picked dry by any vendors that are there, or it's going to, I would assume that the people that are in the area know that the event is coming and would plan on buy listing themselves.
That's interesting, because I feel like people who are currently still in the Magic Sphere are thinking, well, I can sell all my cards at the GP, but I don't know if, so Central Ohio has the Origins Game Fair, and it's pretty hostile to Magic now, but for a good decade, there was a lot of Magic that went on, and I knew people who would go every year, and it's like, okay, well, this year I'm going to bring my Magic cards to sell, or I'm going to buy stuff, and I have to wonder whether casual people or people who haven't played in years still associate a Grand Prix with the thought of there will be vendors there who will want to buy my cards.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to see the way that people decide whether or not to get rid of their collection and when to get rid of that collection. And it isn't necessarily linked to when an event is in your area or when it is you want to get out. And many times it has more to do with things like moving out of the area or changing interests and things like that. Those tend to be the more dominating feature about why someone would choose to sell their things.
So what has been your experience with that, with people who are getting rid of collections? I think I know a lot of people who say, oh, I played years ago, I still have the cards, I'm going to leave them in the closet and my kids will play one day. Do you ever get that, or do you find people who say, I found this in the closet and I want to get rid of it?
You know, most of the time it's people that either they lose their play group and they just want to get rid of the cards because they no longer have anybody to play with, or they are looking for some money for something that they want now that they, you know, like the example of the guy with the Skyrim game where, yeah, he could still play Magic, but his interest isn't there as much. He'd rather get some money for something else. And it's interesting, for the most part, the people that sell their collections, they don't have a financial value in their mind about what these cards are worth. The value they place in them is more related to the amount of money that they spent at that time and the amount of enjoyment they've gotten out of those cards in that time. So, you know, somebody may spend $200 and play Standard for a year or two. That's the value in their mind of what that collection is worth. And regardless of what the actual retail or secondary market value of those cards are.
Now, that's interesting, and also because you were talking about the changing interests, I think, in my experience, they're rarely selling Magic collections just to get money, because sometimes it represents more than that to them, but it's like, it's to finance something else they want, or, you know, it's not like you're selling it for rent money.
Right,
exactly. In my experience, but has that been your experience, that people are like, well, I got bills to pay, or I want to pay my student loans, or what?
No, it always has been more about clearing out the space, just like you would sell anything at a yard sale. Or it's about changing interests. So the younger player who played for a little bit and now wants to buy a video game, wants to, buy a board game, Something along those lines.
Interesting. So I want to circle back a little bit to GP New Jersey. I wasn't able to make it. It was a huge event. I want to hear more about it from your perspective.
Okay, so I arrived a couple hours before the doors opened, and I'm an L1 judge, so I'm comfortable being on site in an event prior to it opening. And when I pulled onto site, the rear bay door was wide open. So while the site was kind of closed down to the general public, they had a very wide open door that I could just walk right in. So I took that opportunity to scope out the scene, find out where the vendors were located, find out where each vendor was located, because I've got a couple favorites in my mind. So keeping those in mind, and then by the time I got that done, I got caught and was asked to leave the site because the doors weren't going to open for a couple more hours. The place filled up very quickly. The lobby was kind of filled in, and we were allowed in right on time. And the very first thing I did was I went to the Star City games booth, which is where I had my store credit, and gave them this collection and asked them to give me a price. They gave me a decent price. It was definitely more than I paid for it. And with the 25% bonus, it was going to be great. But I definitely shopped the collection out to 2-3 more vendors before I came back and decided with Star City. And what was interesting was the approach that many of these vendors take. I mean, they were getting slammed very hard. I'd say within that first hour, every single vendor had all of their buyers busy looking at collections. By the time I had come back to Star City, which is maybe, I shopped it for about an hour before I came back. It was another hour-long wait just to see one of the four Star City buyers. And I saw a continual line the entire day on Friday at Star City's booth, as well as many of the other vendors. It was slammed in terms of how much business was happening.
I feel like that's a recent thing because I've seen, I mean, recent, maybe the past 2 or 3 years, but the explosion of vendors at sites and especially buyers for collections and sets, the collector or the insiders I've interviewed before, store owners talk about how we go to GPs, we don't go to a Grand Prix to sell cards, we go to a Grand Prix to buy cards. And exactly. More and more vendors seem to be hipped right onto that then.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because they end up running out of money and borrowing as much as they can throughout that weekend just to continue to buy and buy as much as they can. I know that it isn't so much present this weekend, but I know that some vendors run out of money by Sunday and they just have to pack things up and leave because they don't have anything else they can pick up. Sure, they're going to sell a little bit on Sunday afternoon, but is it worth it to be staffing and paying for all these people that they have on site with them for those extra additional hours just to sell some foil electricaries to somebody like me?
So, when you've been buying, do you do much speculating where you buy a bunch of copies of a card that you think is going to go up?
You know, being part of the QS community, you can't help but go down that route. You know, I've been a big follower of Brainstorm Brewery as well. They're always on the kind of speculation tip. And there was this one set review they did where it was really this kind of differing philosophy. Is that you could either have the philosophy if you just buy these cards low and you sell them at their current value and you just flip, or you can kind of speculate a little bit and look to the future and be buying cards with the intention of selling them at tomorrow's prices. And yeah, I definitely do that. And I've got my own box of shame as well from that type of speculation. But the thing you got to remember, especially with things like penny stocks, is you only have to be one out of 10 times. And that just pays for all the rest of your losses.
And that's something that we bring up too, is that, you know, you can get in on Sarkhan at $25 and he may hit 40. But if you buy $25 worth of 20-cent rares and you hit, then you're going to hit so much harder than your one Sarkhan hit.
Right. You know, and if you, early on, you just start collecting all those monetary Swift Spears, then you're golden, where you can just now buy list them for 50 cents to a dollar.
So in your speculation, what have been some of your triumphs of speculating?
God, what are some of my triumphs of speculating? I think I did pretty good on Foil Delver. I was able to pick those up early on when they were about $2-3. So I've got a nice stack of 10 to 12 now that I still have that are worth $15 to $20. I'll probably hold on to them for another year or so before I finally out them. You know, I think it's difficult to remember the ones you hit on. It's a lot easier to remember the ones that you failed.
So I think that gets us to the box of shame question. What cards are you sad that you speculated on or bought in collections and that didn't pan out?
You know, I've got this, I just got finished inventorying a bunch of Innistrad, Return to Ravnica era specs, and I found a pile of 30 foiling cackling counterparts. I was convinced they were going to print some populate combo piece that was going to break that card, but it never really came to be.
Cackling counterpart, that puts a token on the battlefield in a play that's a copy of a creature you control. There is yet hope because it is a bad combo with dual caster mage in Legacy.
Okay.
You can make infinite counters of that thing at instant speed if you care to, but I don't blame you. It's a better idea than my box of 20 Hermit Druids that I have. That card's never going to get unbanned. Anything else that you can think of that comes to mind as a card that you're just really hoping that it hits one day because you have a bunch?
You know, the ones that I've really been specking on really hard over the last year has been all of the Infect promo cards. So we've got a Glistener Elf promo. You've got the black 2-drop flying Infect guy.
Mm-hmm.
I've picked up as many of those as I can. I've picked up as many foil mutagenic growths as I can. I've just been going really hard on Infect. And I'm hoping that, that something comes along the line where that deck, I mean, having it make the Legacy Finals, I would hope that would help the card spec a little bit higher. But it still tends to be considered a tier 2 deck in Modern, so I don't have a lot of high hopes, but I still keep hoping, and I still keep picking those cards up. I can't stop getting those promos.
Now, I think that's an interesting spec and a potentially very lucrative one, and here's why. And let's go back to the Foil Delvers, is that Delver is a double-sided card, and they are not going to be reprinting double-sided cards in any box sets or anything like that anytime soon. We could presumably see face down double-sided cards in a new Modern Masters or something, but again, low probability. Infect is another one of those things that we probably won't see again for a very long time. Well, at the same time, Wizards is printing better pump spells. Become Immense comes to mind immediately. That deck will be trending in an upward arc by getting better and better pump spells as we go along. So I think that's an interesting idea.
Oh yeah, no, and that's kind of the thought. What you hit on about the likelihood of reprint, right? That even if we have a Modern Masters 2, I don't expect Infect to be a sub theme that they want to support in a Modern Masters 2 draft format. Now there is some kind of thought to the idea that we have to come back to that storyline at some point, right? We have a new Phyrexia that's been taken over by these Phyrexians. So we definitely need to address that issue at some point. But, the likelihood of returning to Mirrodin again, this new Phyrexia realm within the next 5 years is pretty low. So, as long as people like to combo off with Infect in the next 5 years, then I'm hoping those cards will just keep going higher.
And while that deck is not very good in Modern right now, thanks to all the burn in the Delver decks, that will eventually swing back, and Infect, I think, is a very fine, you know, middle-of-the-road deck to be playing, so I think that's wise. So I've got another question for you, too. In addition to the Box of Shame, I'm wondering, what cards do you regret not selling at their peak? And I'll tell you, I have Jeskai Ascendancy pulled up right now. I remember when it was a dollar, it hit $8, $10 is a flash in the pan, and I know some people were wondering, like, is this card going to hit 15? Where's it going to go? Now its middle price is about $2.50. And the people who were holding those, hoping for it to go higher, definitely got burned. Are there cards that you regret selling or not selling at a price peak?
I'd say that Thundermaw Hellkite is probably comes to mind. That, you know, there's this kind of wave of cards where I remember I did really well with Bonfire of the Damned. I remember trading a Bonfire of the Damned into a Lion's Eye Diamond because they were both $50 at the time. But Thundermaw Hellkite was another one of those cases where that card, I don't know if it hit 50, but it was pretty high. And I think that my desire to play the card kept me from selling, or it was that the buy list price that I could get for the card just wasn't high enough for me to sell out, and I just wasn't willing to go down the eBay path with it at that point. But I remember getting stuck with a lot of those, and that set in particular is really, really bad value. I think Thundermaw is the highest card in Magic 2013. And there's not much else left in the set outside of that, and it's down to 10 at this point.
To be fair, Thundermaw Hellkite is a very fun card to cast and attack with, so I don't blame you at all.
Right.
So when you are getting these collections and picking up cards, how are you selling them through a TCG Player storefront or eBay or just buy lists, or what do you do?
Well, it really depends on where I'm at the time. I just recently moved back to Northern California. I've been back almost a year now. Prior to that, I was in Salt Lake City. So in Salt Lake City, you have access to a lot of travel to PTQs within 6 to 8 hours away. You can get up to Montana. You can get to Idaho. You can get to Vegas. You can get to Colorado. These are all, you know, drivable distances. So the access to shops and buy listing at those shops is good. Having a good relationship with a store owner locally in Salt Lake made things in terms of buy listing very nice. But primarily I would be doing the kind of quick flips on eBay to sell these things off. You know, yes, eBay and PayPal tax you a decent amount, but buy listing is a lot less than what you're going to get out of that eBay transaction. Now that I'm here locally, one thing that was happening was there was a local play group that would play at a pizza parlor, one night each week. And I would just show up with a case and actually put my case there on one of the pizza parlor tables. And I was selling right there in the business.
And they allowed you to do that and they were cool with that?
Yeah. You know, they've been having their local Magic group play there for probably 10, 15 years. And so, they were happy to have the business of those players, and so it was fine having my case there. The employees saw me there making transactions, and they never said a word about it. Other outs, again, local card shops, eBay. I haven't really jumped on the TCG bandwagon yet, and I've thought very highly about going the Crystal Commerce route, both of those things feel like they take a little bit more time and energy I'm willing to dedicate, when a lot of what I can just do is arrive to a GP and flip the collection to a vendor right there.
So do you use Facebook groups at all locally to get to buy or sell cards?
I do. I don't tend to use it so much locally, but I'm definitely a part of Magic Facebook groups along my travel paths. So that way, again, I can advertise. I can also look to buy collections on at my travel path. It's actually looking to be more of a solid shot in terms of being able to find collections through Facebook groups than it does by Craigslist. You're going to get a lot more gold mines, and you're going to get a lot more awesome collections for a lot less money off Craigslist than you are through a Facebook group. But the likelihood of actually getting a collection on your travel route is going to be a lot better on a Facebook group.
And you got to help me out here, too, because you said you were in Northern California, and I'm thinking, you know, you're talking about going to Idaho and Wyoming and Montana, and it's only in the ignorance of my mind here. I imagine there's just vast expanses of nothingness, and there are Magic playing communities out there?
Yes, and those are the Magic communities that you want to find. When I was traveling to these, you know, Montana, Idaho, Denver, Vegas, that was when I was centralized in Salt Lake City. So, now being in Northern California, my kind of directions of travel are north to Portland and south to the Bay Area and east to kind of the Redding, Chico, Sacramento area. And along those routes, there's, you know, as long as there's either an LGS within a couple hours, there is going to be people that are playing Magic the Gathering, and they are going to be a small community, and they are not going to have any sort of idea about what TCG Mid is or what a Star City Games buy list price is. None of that has any relevance to them whatsoever. They just have the cards, they like the cards, they have fun, and it's a different value system for those people.
That's great, and it's also good that you're able to provide the service of ready cash, ready buyer, you know, turn your old collection into, you know, whatever you're into now, video games, Warhammer miniatures, that stuff.
Right.
So what challenges are you facing right now in Magic Finance?
You know, I'd say that the most difficult thing for me is finding the time to manage the labor of sorting, selling, and shipping with my 9-to-5. You know, being a teacher, I'm pretty slammed during the semesters, so once the winter and summer breaks hit, I'm on the road, I'm picking these things up, and trying to find the time to, when I'm not, driving on long, straight areas when I can sort, finding the time to do that stuff. Many times I offsort it, I'll offsource it, I'll hire somebody, pay them, you know, $10 an hour to sort for me, that's only when I really need that collection sorted so I can flip it or so I can get, you know, stored in some long-term inventory kind of a situation. So that's probably the number one. The number two is having, right now, currently where I'm at, I don't have a very strong Magic community in terms of, the shops and competitive level events. GPTs are having a really hard time firing here. We have a TO who, is not the best with the prize support and things along those nature. And so it's hard to kind of really grow and get a stronger Magic the Gathering community locally. And for how remote we are, that's been a challenge to really kind of to make the game bigger and more appealing in a competitive sense, that these people are buying more expensive singles, more competitive singles.
Well, and also, you know, you think about the thing that gets people buying standard decks and wanting to keep collecting and playing is that they have events that they can regularly play in. And I know in the Cincinnati area, Legacy has basically died out over the past year and a half because you started seeing the events here or there wouldn't fire, and people would say, well, you know, I'm not going to drive 45 minutes to the game shop if it means that we're going to be like seven people waiting for an eighth for Legacy to fire for 3 hours. So I think you're exactly right that you got to have that strong local support to keep the local economy moving on it.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is we've had a long we've had one LGS that's been here for many years, and it's only been within the last year that a second LGS that's running FNM and running competitive events has made it into the scene. So they're still growing, and they're a great TO. They're a great person to work with. Like I said, very flexible, allowing people to make purchases and sales inside the store. And that person will grow within the next year or so, and then there'll be some real competition between the LGSs, and the store that is more supportive of its player base will end up winning out in the long run.
So what advice do you have for players who are listening to you and saying, I want to be like Kyle here, buying collections, financing road trips? How would you advise somebody who wanted to get into that?
The number one thing is you have to have a flexible travel schedule. This is something I learned even before I got into Magic Finance, is that if you can plan to have a day before and a day after of where it is you need to be and for what it is you need to do. In the past, before Magic, for me, it was all about the step down from a flight. The first thing I do is I get to that gate and I say, do you need anybody to step down from the flight? 1 out of 10 times, they'll say, well, yes, we do. We overbooked the flight. Here is a $450 travel voucher. We'll get you on a plane to where you need to be sometime within the next day. And having that kind of a philosophy makes these kinds of things more lucrative to you. So in terms of Magic Finance, yeah, you set yourself up with an extra 6 hours of travel time to whatever your destination is to your next PTQ, and you set yourself up with 3 to 4 collections to take a look at, you might not buy all these collections. You might only buy 1 or 2 of them, but that's going to pay for your gas for your entire trip. And not to mention, you're going to be meeting interesting people and seeing cards and collections that you probably wouldn't normally get to see just in your local community.
Well, that's wonderful advice, and I think that you're going to inspire a lot of people to be planning a day or two here, or maybe an afternoon before an event or something after, to see if they can't find some collections locally. So, and that's wonderful advice. I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and I have to say your story of kind of road tripping on this on Magic Collections, it's unique and it's cool, and it's got me pretty fired up to start looking myself.
Yeah, you know, I think people rag a lot about how bad Craigslist is, but I think those people are also thinking about Craigslist locally. They're constantly on Craigslist, they're advertising on Craigslist, and you're gonna have a dry market if you're constantly advertising and looking on Craigslist locally. But finding those Elko, Nevadas, finding those Medford, Oregons, finding those small little communities that are kind of piggybacking on some larger communities, Craigslist, that's where you're going to find your collections, because people that are into this locally, they're not going to drive 2 hours to go look at a collection. But if you're already driving that 2 hours, you're already going to be near that collection. Why not take a look at it?
That's wild. I love it. I love it. Well, Kyle, you've been a wonderful guest here for coming up on an hour. I really want to thank you for coming on the show. And I know you're on Twitter. How can people find you?
The best way that you can find me is on Twitter at brotha52, BROTHA52 on Twitter. I also write financially. There's a link to the website that I write for. I don't want to advertise for him because he's never paid me for his articles. So you can find the link to my finance writing through that Twitter link, and feel free to find me on Facebook as well as Kyle Falbo. And yeah, I look forward to meeting and talking with any of you about this kind of stuff.
Wonderful. Well, I certainly want to circle back and have you back on the show to ask you about more collections later on. And definitely we'll be keeping an eye on the hashtag shop crawlers. And I got to say, you got to keep using it because I want to see some more of those collections.
Yeah, not a problem. I'd love to.
Well, great. Well, Kyle, thank you for being our guest. And for people listening, this is another episode of Insider Stories. It's brought to you by Quiet Speculation. And if you'd like to hear more of these, you can go to mtgcast.com or quietspeculation.com and find the entire archive as well as an RSS feed so that you can keep track of the latest shows. Thank you for listening.